You're listening to Almost Famous with Jim Francis Meza, only on LA Talk Radio.
Guys, welcome to another show of Almost Famous with yours truly, Jim Francis Meza. Last week, as you know, we had a good buddy of mine and neighbor, Thomas Riccio, with his colorful past. Such a crazy, amazing story this guy's got. And, you know, this guy told me he owned one of his homes that he owned in L.A., in East L.A., where the Night Stalker got caught. So there's a lot of coincidence because yours truly used to live in Lincoln Heights. I grew up in Lincoln Heights, just east of the river. And, you know, a friend of my mother, my friend of my mom's, she owned a bar called Marcelino's right there, adjacent to the 5 freeway. And apparently Richard Ramirez, was, living there for a short period of time. So that's what I know. But guess what? I have a great person that's going to fill us in on a whole plethora of things that Richard Ramirez did when he was reigning terror back in 1985, 84 and 85 in Southern California and up and down the coast, up in San Francisco, I think Glassell Park, Rosemead, if I'm not mistaken. Guys, I want to thank you. Why don't we just bring on Mr. Retired Homicide Lieutenant from the Los Angeles Sheriff Department, Mr. Gil Carrillo, guys.
Thank you.
Gil, it's truly an honor to have you on. I know you and I, we had some beers, or you drank all of my beers, but well, we had some laughs over at a Mexican restaurant, and it was fantastic talking to you, and you're so insightful. And thank you for your service, sir, by the way, because I know you also served in the military. Thank you for accepting this invitation so graciously. I appreciate you. So we want to take off with, I don't even know where to take off. I mean, you heard the introduction. I have a lot of connections to you because obviously, you know, you're like the linchpin. You're like, how do I explain, the quintessential idea of the person that nabs the bad guy, in this case being the boogeyman in the 1980s, where most of us were afraid in the 1980s to leave our windows open. It was like hellish hot, you know, in the dead of summer, and we had our windows closed and whatnot. The people didn't have AC like myself, they couldn't afford it. But you and Frank Salerno, right, Lieutenant Gil Carrillo and homicide detective Frank Salerno were instrumental in catching the Night Stalker, essentially. Why don't you tell us, I know it's hard for you to relive the story over and over due to the fact that it took a psychological toll on you, no doubt, and the rest of the world. Why don't you tell us, when we back up, you went to the military, you got out. How did you get involved with the Sheriff Department, sir?
Got involved with the sheriff's department primarily because it was a deputy sheriff that took me home at the age of 17 and told my parents, sign for him to get off the streets or he's going to end up in prison or dead. So at 17, I entered the Army with my parents' signature. 3 years later, after serving a tour in Vietnam, I came back. And the first thing I wanted to do, one of my goals, was to go to college, which nobody in my family, no cousins, no siblings, nobody had ever gone to college. At that time in my life, I was naive, and I thought only rich white people went to college. And I knew I was mature enough to go to college because I sent for my high school transcripts, and I was embarrassed when I received them. I obviously thought D stood for damn good. And so they allowed me to go to start at Rio Hondo College because I was a Vietnam veteran.
Awesome.
Another goal was to go ahead and become a deputy sheriff because I wanted to give back what that cop had given me.
Right.
And he gave me my life.
Wow.
And I wanted to pay it forward and give it back to some other kid or anybody that I could help out in any way, shape, or form. So I was able to accomplish that, and it's been a great career. And I also have to just for the records, make sure everything's straight. At the time that we were doing this investigation of Night Stalker, Frank was a sergeant.
Sergeant.
He was Sergeant Frank Salerno, and I was a mere detective.
Right.
I was a deputy, wow, detective, investigator, Gil Carrillo. It wasn't until later on that I promoted to sergeant, then I went on to lieutenant.
I stand corrected, because you're right, if I will interject real quick. He was obviously credited to have caught the strangler, the Hillside Strangler, if I remember correctly, right?
He was the lead investigator from the Sheriff's Department working with LAPD.
Wow.
That was responsible for the Hillside Strangler case, yes.
Unbelievable. All of us that now, it's unbelievable that now these podcasts, there's podcasts that are dedicated solely to uncovering, like, you know, and talking about it, dissecting, if you will, picking apart cases that were unsolved, cases that have been solved. And then once again, you know, like, we're starting to see a lot of these crimes. It's called crime TV, as we come to coin it nowadays, right? But yes. It's helped in so many ways, because it educates the new people that are coming up. But then also, too, it gives you credit where credit is due, Mr. Gil Carrillo. I really appreciate you.
Thank you. It's very kind of you.
And so, continue on. So you're giving back, and you join the sheriff department. Now you go up the ranks. You're moving up the ranks, and you decide to go into homicide. Or what itch did you get? Or at what point did you feel like you're just going to jump in 2 feet into the homicide department, so to speak?
As a young patrol deputy, when I was working patrol, right there out of East LA Station, right in front of the little, very small little pond of water, the lake, 5019 East 3rd Street, just two blocks west of Atlantic there, is the East LA Sheriff Station.
Sherman Block, right? Sherman Block Station.
Sherman Block was the sheriff. I was a young patrol deputy there, and I remember I had a trainee with me. He was a rookie. And we're inside the station, and we just attended briefing. They gave us a murder call right out of the station. We went
Holy
there
cow.
At Floral and Huck, and Sydney and Floral was a street, and we got there. We have a murder. The short version is the team that got out there, Barrett Fitzgerald and Jack Fuglin from homicide, they got there about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. We were there. We contained the crime scene for him. And he was then Sergeant Fitzgerald. He came up and he introduced himself as Sergeant Barrett Fitzgerald. But kid, I want you to call me Fitz. I said, yes, sir. He says, no, I didn't say sir. I said, call me Fitz. I said, okay, Fitz, my name's Gil. Pleasure to meet you. And he says, so tell me what went on. How'd you get this call? And I started to tell him, and he said, hold on, wait a second. Who's that over there looking at the car? I said, that's the watch commander. That'd be a lieutenant. And we had just gotten this brand new yellow caution tape, the keep out stuff, and right, new policy. Anybody that went in had to sign the log sheet indicating they went into a crime scene. And he said, who is it? I said, that's the watch commander. And he said, what's he doing? I said, I have no idea. I asked him to sign the login sheet. And he looked at me, reminded me of my position as deputy and him as a lieutenant. And he does whatever he wants. He tells me what to do. I don't tell him what to do. And he went in there and took a look.
Wow.
And he said, oh, okay, we'll just hold that thought. And he walked right up to the lieutenant and introduced himself as Sergeant Barrett Fitzgerald. Didn't tell him, but you can call me Fitz. And he said, might I ask what you're doing here? He said, well, I was just looking over at the crime scene, looking at the remains here. And he said, would you do me a favor? He said, how about stepping on the other side of that tape and look at the remains from the other side of that tape like everybody else?
Wow.
And once homicide gets there, it's their crime scene. They are in charge. The lieutenant turned beet red, stomped off, got in his car, and took off. And I said, yes, I like the control that you have when you're working homicide. So I left that night at 11 o'clock to go home. I came back the next day for my 3 o'clock car again, and the two investigators were still there. They hadn't gotten home, were in the same clothes. They'd been working all night long, and they were just dedicated, meticulous.
Wow.
And they really impressed me, and I just decided then, when I grow up, that's what I want to do. Those guys are good.
Amen.
And, you know, when they get on a crime scene, everybody gets out of their way. They're respected, everything. That's homicide.
Yes.
And That's what I wanted to do. That had to be about 1975.
Wow. And
1981, I was called up to homicide. Fantastic. That's where I worked gangs for a while, East L.A. And
yeah.
I got up to homicide March 23rd of 1981, where I spent 21 years as an investigator.
Yes, sir.
Went home for a bit and then came back, finished off my career five years as a team lieutenant, where I had 14 homicide investigators working for me.
Unbelievable. Fantastic. What a great story you got. You're just unbelievable trajectory you have behind you. And talk about trailblazing. I mean, I have followed your career to some extent. I mean, obviously, we're doing this for the viewership that's watching. And thanks, guys, for watching Almost Famous with yours truly, Jim Francis Mesa and Mr. Gil Carrillo. And I got to say, like, it's remarkable. I mean, like, talk about, I want you to also, like, really, we're going to, you know, deep dive a little into how the times have changed. I mean, with what we have now in terms of technology, you think you probably would have zeroed in on the Night Stalker a lot quicker than you guys did? Or you think what's your take on that?
No, I don't think we'd have caught him any sooner.
No.
The big thing that we have today that we didn't have then was DNA.
Right.
But DNA, at that time, only felony convictions were put into the system. Fingerprints, only felony fingerprints were automated at that time.
And he was a petty criminal, right?
He was a misdemeanor. He had a misdemeanor conviction for auto theft.
Holy cow.
And that was it.
Wow. So you guys didn't have so much to go on.
No, sir. It took, when I first got to homicide, they told me, kids, sit down.
Wow.
You're going to, you know, we have a vested interest in you, because I was young and I was the youngest guy in homicide bureau probably for the first 7 years. They called me the kid up there.
Wow.
And they said, and I thought I was going to be dumped on, because it was unheard of. It takes a minimal average of 15 years to get to Sheriff's Homicide Bureau. Wow. And I had less than 10 when they called me and asked me to go up there. And I was awestruck, you know, and I was floating.
Wow.
And but I thought they were really going to dump on me because I hadn't paid my dues. You know, I hadn't been a seasoned investigator by the time I got up there. And so one guy sat me down and he said, we have a vested interest in you. We have a reputation. We have a reputation for being good. You're going to be good. And if you're not good, and if you try doing things on your own, we're going to roll your ass up and kick you back to patrol where you belong. And so they established the level of expertise and dedication that you needed at that time to do it. And they told me, to solve murders, you have to follow the three S's. And that was snitches, shoe leather, and scotch. And that's how you solve cases. Now,
wow.
A lot of shoe leather, a lot of snitches. I still haven't acquired a taste for scotch, so I didn't drink. I didn't do the scotch.
Wow, that's insane. It's interesting. You know, like, I mean, when you guys were literally going on basically crumbs, right? Like, just whatever good policing, also instincts on your end, I believe some of that kind of fell into play, because they were thinking it was more than one person committing these atrocious crimes, correct?
That's right. Nobody, and it's, I don't blame them for the way they were thinking. Criminal profiling is something that started with the Behavioral Science Unit in Quantico, Virginia, the FBI. And what they did was they got all this information from cops all around the United States, input it into computers. So you said, okay, I got a suspect doing this. You call them and they come back and they tell you, okay, you're looking for a 25-year-old white male or a Mexican.
Right.
Somebody's, they give me this criminal profiling. Well, the things we were alleging, or the things that I was alleging at that time, nobody in criminal history had ever been documented doing. And I owe so much of this case, not only to my colleagues that I work with and to the citizens that helped out,
right?
But I had a professor at Cal State LA by the name of Dr. Robert Morneau.
Very
cool. Took two semesters of advanced criminal investigation pertaining to sex crimes. And he gave me the knowledge to work the case. I could see things from his teaching that I had learned that most cops had never heard of and didn't believe in. So therefore, when he makes a deliberate noise at the first one of our murders, Maria Hernandez's house,
right?
He made a deliberate noise. He wanted to see her face.
And Rose did, right? That's the lady that got shot in the face? Or she
had the one that got shot in the hand.
Right.
He pointed the gun. She had her hands right in front of her.
That's correct.
Then he shot Dale Okazaki right in the forehead, but we found out at autopsy that he had hit her in the back of the head first.
Oh.
Not with a bullet. It just hit her with something heavy, like the gun.
Right.
And we found it at autopsy. And so right away, Dr. Morneau, I remembered him very vividly saying, sexual deviants, they like to see the fear in your face. They may not be ready to shoot you. They just want to see if that's like foreplay to them.
Oh, and the whole goodness.
Incident is a sexual incident to them.
Right.
So he saw Maria full of fear. He shot her. And then she went down to the ground. She got up, hit the garage door opener. She went out the back garage door again, down the alley. She hears a second shot coming from inside her condominium proper. And she had a roommate in there, Dale Okazaki. She then went around the front because she figured he'd go out the back door like her. And he come out the front door. They were just as shocked. She was to see him. He was to see her. And they played cat and mouse around a Volkswagen, you know, going back and forth one way or the other.
Yeah.
And finally, she just threw her hands up and she said, don't shoot me again. You've already shot me once. And there's no fear.
Right.
He put the gun down by his side and walked away. Didn't run away. He walked.
Walked.
40 minutes later, he dragged Silin Yu out of a car after a panic stop. He had been following her. She backed up. She backed up into a parked car. He went and drug her out of the car, shot her on the left side of her abdominal wall twice, and then left her in the street. Wow. Now, why didn't he shoot her when she was in the car if that's all he wanted was to kill her?
Gratification, huh?
Yeah.
Sexual gratification.
That's what was in my mind.
Right.
That's what was going through me. And when you have somebody like Maria Hernandez that is surviving and gives us a physical description.
Yes.
Shortly after that, we had a staff artist. We were just transitioning from something that was called an Identikit, which was clear acetate paper, the kind you show in overhead projection.
Right.
The old days.
Yeah.
Well, you'd take out of a box and they had eyebrows, lips, noses, cheekbones, chins, everything different, mustaches, beards.
Yeah.
And you put them all together. Then you put them on a Xerox machine and you come up with a photo.
The composite. A deal.
A composite of what the guy looks like.
Yeah.
Well, we had a staff artist go sit down with Maria Hernandez, and she told him what she saw. So he just started drawing. And she says, yes, that a little more cheekbone over here, a little of this, a little of that. And she says, that's him right there.
Wow.
So I took that drawing down to one of our stations over at East LA, and I'm telling the detectives over there when one guy comes up to me and says, from our crime lab, and he says, hey, Gil, I got something in the car I want to show you. And he comes in. He's actually 12-year-old girl. There was an attempt kidnap out of Pico Rivera.
Holy and shit. That's close to home.
Yeah.
That hits home. Yeah.
He brought that Identikit in, and you put the Identikit in the composite along with the staff artist drawing, and it looks like the same person.
Holy moly.
When you look at the physical descriptions, they're the same. Tall, right. Thin, Mexican, Caucasian or light-skinned Mexican, disheveled hair, stained gap, teeth.
Wow.
And a pungent odor. You know, he had a nasty odor to him. And so now I've got a 12-year-old girl saying this. I've got Maria Hernandez saying this. I've got him killing them two. Nothing happens to the 12-year-old girl. Then we find out at the end of March that Maxine and Mr. and Mrs. Azar in Whittier.
Oh, dear Lord. That was a
tough one.
They
were both killed. That's up there by Rose Hills.
Yeah. So the lady had the shotgun, but then the shotgun wasn't loaded. Right.
I don't know if she had a shotgun and not loaded. That's what it says in the book that Phil Carlo wrote.
Okay.
Part of the stuff that he wrote in that book he got from Richard. So I know he cut her eyes out and he stabbed her a bunch of times. And what we found there, he stepped on a 5-gallon pink can, empty pink can,
right,
to climb through the bathroom window. Then in the flower bed, not far from there, he left the footprint.
Okay.
And that footprint became extremely valuable. It was almost right. like a fingerprint. And so we identified it, and then we saw it again at a child abduction. So now I've got child abduction with a footprint. I've got murder with a footprint. I've got physical descriptions, and it's gelling. So now I'm thinking, okay, this is one guy doing it. That's my opinion and my stuff. I'm telling you,
it's beautiful.
The knowledge I got from Robert Morneau.
My alma mater, Cal State LA. I graduated from there myself. That's fantastic. I'm super, you know, like it helped you out because it now give you a leg up from most, you know, I wouldn't say amateur. I don't think that's the right name for the lack of a better word, but maybe a novice, you know, you
well,
had more.
It didn't help the my in the beginning cops who were supposed to be professional. They had a lot of doubts about me only because I was young.
Yeah.
A young kid trying to make a name for himself. And they didn't believe any of this because they had never heard of it. You know, this is horseshit.
Yeah.
They didn't, and I understand it.
Right.
But eventually.
You proved yourself, man.
And we came up with enough evidence between ballistics and physical evidence. We had enough. We were able to come up with a conviction.
And now, Gil, like, you know, you're walking us through this. And, like, I'm hanging on every word, by the way. And some of it, obviously, just thinking about it, I'm almost vicariously living through it, you know, like the people, what were they thinking and whatnot. But I'm wondering, I can't help but think, like, it was really uncommon for a guy like Richard Ramirez, you know, to have, you know, for a Hispanic guy to be doing this, right? Like, it wasn't common for a Latino to be causing these types of murders, and furthermore, to get off and tie him up the way he did. And, you know, it was insane how I understand some of the accounts, you know, from people like that I've come across on online mostly. I don't know how accurate they are, but, you know, he had different fetishes that he would do, and a lot of times he would have sex with like 79-year-old lady and maybe an 80-year-old lady sometimes after he had shot him. Is that correct? Is that accurate?
No.
Okay.
No, we don't know that he had sexual intercourse with anybody that was deceased.
Okay.
No, we didn't have that. His victims ranged in age.
Yeah.
From 6 years old all the way up to, in their 70s. In their 80s. The 85. The 80. Two sisters.
Yeah.
They were in their 80s.
Okay. But up until, like, Richard, let's go back on, you know, like, maybe... Perhaps just talk a little bit about Richard's upbringing. I believe some of the accounts, you know, Richard had a pretty bad, like, upbringing. Dad was very abusive, would tie him up to a cemetery, you know, headpiece or something. He'd be there, like, overnight. And
those are all that stuff that you're talking about.
Uh-huh.
It's all myths that
myths.
Come about
okay.
on the internet. People
okay.
that think they know what they're talking about, and they don't.
Okay.
Did his dad beat him? Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, his dad beat him. And his dad used to laugh at times. And this is coming straight from Richard.
Hmm.
You know, his dad would beat him. And then the only place he could go to get peace and relaxation was the cemetery.
Okay.
He would go sleep in the cemetery.
All right.
And I'm saying, good God. You know, I'm sitting there, Rich. Because he called me Gil, I called him Rich.
Yeah, yeah, that's the other thing we're going to talk about.
He called my partner Mr. Salerno. He had nothing but respect for Salerno. Richard was an avid reader, and he followed...
The Hillside Strangler, right?
He followed all serial killers. He says, in his words, quote, unquote, I've got an ego that'll fill this room. I can tell you anything about serial killers from the time the Romans fed the Christians to the lions to the modern-day serial killers. Him and Ted Bundy used to write to each other back and forth while they were both in prison awaiting their sentence. So he knew all about it. And I'm looking, I'm saying, Rich, God damn it, how could you go sleep in the cemetery? Hey, it was relaxing, Gil. It didn't bother me. And that was before he was into Satanism.
So this is a real thing? I thought for some reason it was like shock value. You know what I mean? The whole Satanism. He was really a Satanist?
Yeah, he was practicing.
As a practicing Satanist.
Sure.
Wow.
And people, you know, when they said, Gil, weren't you nervous or afraid when you went in there the first time?
Yeah.
You're so weak within Satanism. And the realities are, Satanism is nothing more than another form of religion.
Right.
All it is. And Richard, they said, were you afraid? I said, absolutely not. Richard was nothing more than human.
And the other thing was, go ahead.
Just like a football player, you know, like Peyton Manning.
Yeah.
You know, and he's the quarterback of the team. But, you know, Monday through Saturday, I mean, this guy's a father or brother or friend, and he goes to bars, shoots pool with his buddies,
right.
His husband, dad. Everything's normal. But Sunday, once he straps that helmet on,
yeah,
everything else is pushed outside, and he's a professional football player.
But it's fair to say that Richard Ramirez was anything but normal, right? I mean, in terms of the way he looked, his physicalities, you know, like this bad breath that was just overwhelmingly bad. And he looked a certain way. His eyes were that of a demon, you know. And did people say that? Or, again, we're talking about myth.
They do say that, but that beauty's in the eye of the beholder.
Right.
So Richard was the most articulate murderer I've ever spoken with.
Wow.
Very articulate. He's no dummy.
Right.
And he did speak, you know, he spoke like he was from the barrio, so he had that Mexican.
The lingo, right? Gang,
He had that. But then that's why we became friends, because I could speak right there with him.
Wow, you just said something interesting. You guys became friends. I was going to say, like, were you guys like pal?
We didn't. Don't mix it. We weren't friends. We were never friends.
Right.
I had a job to do.
Right.
And that was to keep him talking. I wanted to have him talk as much as possible.
Right.
In order to do that, I had to
infiltrate, huh?
Yeah, of I sorts. Had to put on an act to get over there. It was all, this is what I wanted.
Right.
I never once raised my voice at Richard. I never once called him any name, never cussed him out, never talked bad about his family. Didn't do anything like that. But make no mistake about it, we were never friends. I mean, I'm not inviting him down to dinner. You know,
you would have been his dinner, by the way.
I mean, listen to one of my dear friends who worked on a case on a crime lab, and she was also in that Netflix documentary.
Okay.
Said he just had that evil look. You could see the evil in his eyes.
Yeah.
That's all in your own mind. I never saw an evil man. I saw man.
Right.
And I was never concerned about how evil he was or how bad he looked. His bad breath, he had rotten teeth.
Yeah.
You know, so his hygiene wasn't that good. And the pungent odor that they kept talking about.
Yeah.
He wore we called his kill kit, black members only type jacket.
Right.
He wore the same shoes all the time, the same pants.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then if you'd imagine if you were a football player or any kind of athlete at high school, even just regular gym, you'd go put your gym clothes back in the locker and close the locker. After the end of the week, they stunk.
Yeah.
Well, he was putting his kill kit. He had a locker in the Greyhound Bus Depot.
That's right. 7th Street, huh?
And so he kept them in a bag. He'd just take them out. So now you got these bloody clothes and they're stinking.
Oh.
That's what people were smelling. You know, when I talked to him, the day he was arrested, because he had just gotten off a Greyhound bus to get on an RTD bus.
That's
you know,
right.
Try to get back to East L.A. He had a brother that lived right there on Brannick Avenue in East L.A.
That's where he was trying to get to, right?
That's where he was trying to get to. If he'd have made it there, the chase would have been on. But fortunately, he didn't. So he didn't have on dirty, smelly clothes.
Okay.
He didn't have his pill kit on him. And people ask, well, did he smell? No, he didn't smell. You know, they. I think somebody said he had goat's breath or something. You know, I didn't smell any of that stuff.
It's all mythical, you know. It's insane. But I'm just trying to have a little lighthearted moment. I mean, this whole thing is a lot to unpack and to take in. You know, for me anyway, You know, and the thing is, I commend you because you were a military guy. So it was not like you were ready to make chop suey out of the guy who had it come down to it. You know what I mean? I really believe you're a real tall guy. You and I are about same height, right? I think you're like, what, 6'4", 6'3"?
6'3".
Yeah, I'm about like an inch taller than you, maybe. If that, I don't tower over you at all. You're a tall guy, big dude. I'm sure you could have taken him down. And was there... It begs the question, now that you're retired, would you have taken, would you want, did you want, like, there was, like, a moment, had you had this perfect moment, you know, obviously we're talking about for the purpose of a show, that maybe you would have, like, you'd have wanted to just rip him a new one, just take him down, go to town on him. Just,
I had very, very mixed emotions.
Right.
One side of me wanted him dead.
Right.
Period.
Okay.
The other side of me wanted him alive because I wanted to talk to him. I wanted to learn from him. So I didn't want him hurt.
Right. Right.
And I would never hurt anybody. That's just me.
Right.
As a person, I would never hurt anybody just to hurt them because I hated them that bad.
No.
I could never do that. And I didn't. And the good citizens from East LA didn't put the boots to him like everybody thinks.
It wasn't like that either, right? Okay, no, why don't you go ahead and walk us through that? What happened exactly?
Here's a guy that's been running. He got off the bus at La Arena and Olympic.
Okay.
So he had to run.
Right. By the freeway. It's adjacent to the freeway. La Arena, yeah. Freeway. Okay. The five.
And La Arena goes north and south. So that goes right over the freeway.
Correct.
But he got off at La Arena. Right. And then he started running.
Okay.
And he ran down Olympic through part of the Estrada Courts, over through residences, over the sound wall to the 5 freeway, across the freeway, over the sound wall to the other side.
This guy was an athlete, man.
Yeah, exactly. Running through yards and jumping fences. He gets over to Indiana because he's trying to move eastbound. He gets to Indiana. He runs into the county area now.
Okay.
So he crosses Indiana, ends up on Hubbard. Okay. He tries to carjack a man for his car. He backs it into a wall, doesn't get out, gets out, goes up the street, tries to carjack a lady. She's screaming. And in Nevada, there's only two kinds of Mexicans over there, the good ones and the bad ones.
That's right.
The bad ones all have guns. They're armed to the gills. They're ready to go. The good ones all have a piece of wood, a baseball bat, a pipa, something to defend themselves with.
The water hose or something, worst case scenario.
The husband... He heard his wife screaming. He runs out there with a pipe.
Okay.
And he hits Richard with a good coscorón twice.
All right. Pops him over the head.
Richard now just starts getting away. The neighbors hear the screaming. They see their neighbor hit him in a fight. They start running after him. He gets about 4 houses down. He finally just gives up. He's out of gas.
Completely out of gas, yeah.
And they just surrounded him and held him until the deputies got there.
Wow. Bless their hearts. It's so great. Well... It's fair to include that they the reason why he was running was because he had already his face was all over the news, right? So at that point he had seen himself. Is that much is true, right? Went into the liquor store, he saw himself in the newspaper. He said, "Holy shit, they're onto me!" And then he got on the MTA, or back then it was the RTD. And then he rode public transportation straight down Olympic. And hopped off? Did he jump off? Do you think a lot of that was because people in the bus were, like, pointing at him kind of thing?
At Olympic and Soto, another pastor was looking at the morning paper.
Okay.
And looked at the paper, looked at the picture, looked over at Richard, and immediately...
Dead ringer, huh?
Tugged the ringer, got off. Richard saw him going right to the phone booth right next door.
That's right.
To the bus. So Richard knew he had been made. He stood on until Olympic. Nobody else had made him on the bus. Richard... flagged down a truck from the gas, Southern
Gas
California
Company.
Was going by, flagged down. He said, "Follow that bus. The killer's on the bus."
Wow.
That's part of the chase.
Okay. And that's hence why he was running. And then eventually he was out of gas. He just gave up. And did he flag a cop? Did he flag a sheriff, a deputy?
No.
That's true. Okay.
He was down on the ground. They encircled him. He wasn't going to go anywhere. They weren't going to let him go anywhere. They didn't know. Initially, they didn't even know who he was. They just thought he was somebody trying to hurt a lady.
Right.
Our neighbor. So the cops were called. The cops were called. So they were just holding him right there. My understanding was a little kid. They kept telling him, "That's him. That's him. That's him." And they kept telling the kid, "Back off. You know, you're going to get hurt. Get back. Get back." And as it was, they called paramedics. The deputy that arrived, his name was Andres.
Right.
Andy Ramirez.
Yes.
And first thing he had to do was he called paramedics because he had cuts in his head. So the paramedics came there and they wrapped his head in gauze, looked like a turban. And then LAPD came up because it's just half a block into the county.
That's correct.
They had been following calls from him jumping in the yards as he's running from the city over to the county side. Mm-hmm. And they just walked up to the car and they said, yep, that's the guy we've been after. And they took him right out of the deputy's car, put him in their car, took off to Hollenbeck.
It begs the question, between the different agencies, you have the sheriff department, obviously you're talking about county, and then there's LAPD, right? Okay, were you guys sharing information? I mean, at what point did you guys realize, okay, we have to share the information that we have because we have to partner up? Or was that always from the get-go, right out of the gate?
Once we realized there was a serial killer going on, it was connected to LAPD cases, we met with the LAPD, our counterparts from LAPD, Leroy Orozco and Paul Tippin,
okay,
from Robbery Homicide Division. We met with them. We said, okay, guys, here's the deal. We don't care who makes the arrest. We don't care who solves the case. Mm-hmm. But we need to have open lines of communication. Right. Forget the brass. We don't need the brass for anything.
Right.
Let's just work hard, have as much fun as we can, and keep all communication open. That's what we did. I've never worked a better case with the guys from LAPD in my career. There was plenty of communication. We met with them almost on a daily basis.
Okay. Wow. So that's great. So there's a lot of myths and we're definitely, you know, clearing the air there in so many ways. I mean, because there's a lot of stuff that's fictional, it's Hollywood, if you will. And
sure.
Then, fact from fiction, and definitely thank you for clearing that and for, you know, definitely, you know, bringing us up to speed with what really took place as opposed to what's out there, you know. Let me ask you this. Can you share a specific moment you felt like during the whole Night Stalker investigation that was particularly like memorable or impactful to you on a personal level?
Yeah, there was still one day we're in a meeting with the captain, the administrative lieutenant, my partner Salerno and myself, and there's still some question whether we have one serial killer or two serial killers work in the county area and the city area. And there wasn't evidence to prove certain one way or another.
Right.
And then we got a phone call from our crime lab during that meeting. And Frank took the call, wrote down the notes. They came back and they said, okay, the gun used in Sun Valley was the same gun that was used in Whittier.
Okay.
And the same gun that was used over here. In LAPD's area was the same gun that killed Sila and you and
right.
Dale Okazaki. And so now that made no serial killer. That made one serial killer working. And the admin lieutenant just looked up and said, Gil Creel, sounds to me like it's your turn to go out in that squad room, jump up on a desk and say, na 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 na. You're the only one that's got it right from beginning to right now. And I said, that sounds good, but we got work to do. We went out and continued working the case.
Right. That's really interesting. So the guy got a little sloppy, as they always tend to do, right? They mess up in one way or another. And then that kind of helps the case. It really helps crack the case eventually, right? Because they do, I mean, meaning he got sloppy in certain ways, right? Do you think, being that he used the same gun, I mean, you know, also his method of, because, you know, the guy killed a certain way. I mean, it was very obvious, probably at some point it became obvious to you, you think, that
no,
it was one
no,
guy?
Just the exact opposite.
Okay.
His only consistency was his inconsistency.
Okay.
He killed with guns, different calibers, different guns, blunt force trauma,
okay,
manual and ligature strangulations, stabbing, cutting, you name it, he did it.
It was a tough one to crack, huh? It really was.
Time, the FBI used to have, they used to categorize serial killers as organized and disorganized.
Okay.
And organized always had, went into a killing and used his tools to kill.
Okay.
He's prepared to kill. The disorganized would go into some place and use whatever opportunity he had to grab a weapon. In this case, Richard did both. Every time he went in, according to him, he had guns on him. Sometimes he used them, sometimes he didn't.
Okay.
Those that acquiesced survived, those that didn't died. So it was just a very difficult case.
Wow.
We were hot on it. 2 weeks, a week before his arrest, when he hit down in Mission Viejo,
okay,
we told our captain, we'll have him in 2 weeks. And we had no idea who he was.
Wow.
had absolutely no idea, but we knew we were closing in on. By this time, we had an informant.
Right.
And we'll have him in 2 weeks. And he was actually captured the following Saturday.
Unbelievable. So
take luck or skill any day.
Let me ask you this. So after the fact, you roll into Hollenbeck. I think Hollenbeck Division was where they brought him down to, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And then there's an outcry, an outpour of people that are just, you know, running amok, coming out to see who this killer is. And this is prior to social media, so it was a full frenzy, right? And so you, at some point, you're thrust into the spotlight, right? I mean, like, you're there, Mr. Captain Salerno's there as well. And then both of you guys are in the car with him when you bring him in. First, you bring him in for interrogation. Is that correct?
He was already there in the interrogation room in Hollenbeck
when
we got. So we interrogated him there. And then we had to wait until we got more officers around for security.
Right.
Around him, because there were literally hundreds, if not thousands, of people. The streets were blocked. People were in a frenzy.
Mm-hmm.
They were excited. They were in party mood.
Right.
And so we had to wait until we had enough backup. And then Paul Tippin drove the car. I rode front passenger, and I carried the guns. And Frank Salerno and Leroy Orozco sat in the back seat with Richard. And then we went out. We had a motorcade in front of us and a helicopter overhead. We had motor officers, radio cars, and it was an incredible ride from Hollenbeck. Just, you know, 5-10 minute ride to Men's Central Jail where he was. There you see us walking him into Men's Central Jail.
Now there's a point where you say that you guys drive off, and then there's the woman that flashes, that clearly is flashing Richard Ramirez, right?
Yes.
So this hand starts the beginning of like a fanboy or fanship of like people coming, pen pals and pictures probably, and women flocking to the courthouse, right, to see this criminal, this guy they were obsessed with, right?
Yes, it had a following.
Excuse me.
I don't know that anybody knew what the lady did, because we didn't go public with it.
Right.
And it wasn't any news coverage, but she did. It just different kind of, you know. People are different, you know. They do whatever they want to.
Yeah, I. It reminds me. Last week, I had my neighbor, and believe it or not, he's a good friend of mine, Thomas Riccio, who has something to do with the O.J. Simpson case, and I had him here at the studio, and we were talking about the O.J. Simpson case a little bit, and just a tad went on a tangent, talk about a few other things that, because he's, you know, he's got so much going on in his life. That we talked about, and you know, during the O.J. Simpson murder, my son's mom and her friends actually somehow, they were kids and they were obsessed with the books and whatnot. They broke into, well, they were obsessed with the Manson family, and they read the book on the Manson family, and so they somehow ended up in Westwood, I believe, is where the condo once stood, right? And they got inside this place, and they were able to see the crime scene from just enough where they weren't like obstructing any of it, but they were there, you know, and they got to see some of it and whatnot. And there are people that are like major, like diehard fans of this stuff, you know. And back then, I mean, you have the Manson family, hence the Manson family. You know, they all these girls that were obsessed with Charles Manson, and I mean, that's a whole other thing we could delve into another day. But most definitely, Richard Ramirez, it seemed like he had a huge fan base, right? Of these.
Yes.
Now,
he still does. He's always dead.
Wow.
He still has a large fan base, and those people sit there. They contact. I get messages.
That's what I was going to say.
Fans of his that say, I should be dead. Richard should be alive.
Wow.
They said lied about everything, and it was all bullshit. He was kangaroo court.
Uh-huh.
You know, they say a lot of things, and they get their power from sitting behind a computer.
Right.
And when asked, does it bother you? No, it doesn't. You
know, like computer sleuths, right? It's just digital people.
They can say anything they want. I know what it is. I've lived it. I've retired.
Right.
Those people don't have, you know, they have free time.
Right.
Too much free
time. Too much time on their hands, right? What does it say? Too much time on your hands, like the devil's playground, right?
Yeah, that's right.
I was going to say, I know you had some emotional dissonance coming on the show because you were watching the game and other, you know, the Angels and the Dodger game and all that. It went south. But I was going to tell you, we're winding down right to down to like five more minutes. There's always clearly a case that you wish it would have gotten solved on your watch. I mean, was there one that got away, so to speak? What can you speak about it publicly?
Yeah, I can, because I'm not going to name anybody, but I
right,
had one
right.
case where husband died. He got shot in the garage. I believe the wife did it.
Wow.
It took her about 45 minutes before the cops were called. She called her comadre at first. And this was after she had taken a shower.
Right.
And gotten rid of everything. We found the holster, but we never did find the gun. And she agreed to take a polygraph. And within a half hour, she backed down. And I know she did it. I can't prove that there wasn't enough evidence. She'll always remain as a suspect in my book.
Right.
She wanted the insurance money. The insurance company called me up. Their attorneys called me up. And they said, well, have you cleared her yet? I said, no. So do you have a suspect? I said, yes. I said, who is it? I said, it's your client. And they said, well, you're going to have to change that, because if not, we're going to sue you. I said, I don't care. Sue me. We've got attorneys on the county side, too.
Right.
Do what you got to do. Right now, she's my primary suspect.
Okay.
There's no doubt in my mind she did it. And one day she's going to meet her maker just like everybody else does.
Amen to that. Turn up the heat on all those criminals. Soulless creatures, monsters, if you will. Real quick, Gil, we talked about how people reached out to you. I know he wasn't your pen pal. I mean, needless to say, he was a monster. But did Richard Ramirez, you know, in the latter years before his death, did he reach out to you? Like, maybe sent you letters, emails?
Philip Carlo, who wrote a book on the Night Stalker case,
okay.
He told me that Richard wanted to talk to me again. And Richard had told me before we said our goodbyes down here, he said in about 7 years, I'll let you come up and visit. Because he said he was good for four more murders that we weren't aware of.
Holy shit.
The truth of the matter was, we looked at about eight other murders that we thought he might be involved in, but there wasn't enough evidence.
Right.
And we didn't want to mess up our case. So we didn't do anything with him. Well, during that 7 years, I was contacted by Phil Carlo. And he said, hey, Richard would like you to go up there. And then Richard got married. And when Richard got married, I got contacted by the news media. And I went off. I said, hey, I think it's a mockery of the criminal justice system. I think it's a mockery of the sacrament of marriage. Number one, he wasn't put in there for rehabilitation. Mm-hmm. He was sentenced to death. We owe him nothing, but somebody decided, you know, in the grand scheme of things, that he has rights. And so we got to afford him a marriage.
Right.
He'll never consummate his marriage, and so it's a mockery, the sacrament of marriage.
Right, you know? Totally.
And so,
150%.
And nothing good to say about it.
No.
And he gets the news, he watches the news up there, and it was televised, it was written about. So I sent a couple of investigators up there on another case, and I said, hey, when you're up there, see if Richard wants to talk.
Right.
And so they went up there, and he was excited because homicide investigators were down here from LA, and they said, hey, you know Gil Carrillo? He said, yeah. So he wants to know if he wanted to come up and visit. And he very angrily said no when he turned around and walked back, you know, away from the window back to his bunk. So I never got to see him.
I you know what? He got exactly what he deserved, I'm sure, like in hell, you know, he'll spend the rest of eternity there. I was gonna ask you, with regards to, I know this is like a fresh case and we have 2 minutes. There's a new case where, did you hear about the nudist ranch with the two, where the couple?
Yeah.
Yep. What's your take? What do you think happened there? You think there's more bodies underneath? Is that a fact?
I have no idea, nor would I speculate, because somebody else is working that case.
Got it.
There's, I don't want to get involved in the speculation of it. I know they've got him in custody and they found the bodies underneath where he was living. So there's a pretty good chance that he did it and hit him.
Wow. Yeah. You know, real quick, Hubbard Street, you guys made a movie. I think Angel Garrett, who I actually know, he's a personal friend of mine, or, you know, we haven't spoken in a while, but he plays Richard Ramirez, correct?
Oh, I don't remember his name.
Yeah.
Nice. really nice guy.
He's a Venezuelan actor. Mm-hmm.
Craig Williams was the director.
Okay.
And they invited me to do a cameo appearance.
Awesome.
They turned it into a speaking appearance, you know, and I did some acting.
Awesome.
And they said, you know, they were going to call me, my name, my movie name was Rafael.
Right, right. Rafa.
And I said, no, we got to change that name to Rafa. Nobody,
Rafa.
No respectable that I don't be called Rafael.
So Rafa is like Ralphie that. Guy, so.
Yeah, and they let me, first they gave me written lines, but then they changed it. They said, you know what, you just improvise, you know, we'll give you the scene,
and
you just do your thing.
Fantastic.
And so it was fun, it was different. When I first went out there, the first day of shooting, I was nervous as a whore in church.
Oh, you weren't.
After that, it became fun. It was natural.
You're natural.
And I don't want to be a spoiler alert, but
it's a hell of a movie, huh? It's going to be epic.
It's going to be, it's different. You know, it's all Raza.
Yeah.
With Penny Trejo's
name
in there. And I get to play a major role in his ultimate capture.
Rightly so. And
not as a cop. So it's poetic justice.
That's
not as a
cop. Hey, that's great. You know, it's funny because real quick, we got one more minute. As an actor, you know, we get to flesh out characters, right? And sometimes we get to vicariously live through something that we normally wouldn't be. So this gives you an opportunity to be on the opposite side of the law, right?
Yeah, it does.
Yo, we gotta bring you back for part two. I mean, there's so many other questions I have. We're out of time. What are your social media handles for people that are watching?
Real Gil Carrillo. That's Instagram.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just Gil Carrillo on Facebook. And that's about it.
You're a true hero to the city of Los Angeles. I owe you a great debt of respect. I really care about you, man. And you and I have become friends. So God bless you. I appreciate you for coming on. And otherwise, that's my show for tonight. Guys, thanks so much, Mr. Gil Carrillo. Guys, give it up.
Thank you. God bless you all. And thank the fans that get out there and watch. Follow your podcast.
Thank you, buddy. Appreciate it.
You bet.
You're listening to Almost Famous with Jim Francis Meza, only on LA Talk Radio.
Yo, are you still there? I'll call you. I'll call you on the phone. I'll call you on the phone. Okay.